You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. My name is Michael Wolin. I'm going to begin my readings today with some commentary on the Parsha of the week. This is the part of the Torah, the portion, Parsha is portion of, we are in the book of Exodus, and the title is Beishalach, and the commentary is by Rabbi Yonatan Sacks, who is the former chief rabbi of Great Britain. He titles this, The Power of Ruach. What is Ruach? Well, you'll get an idea from his commentary. Now, this particular Torah portion deals with the plagues have happened. The plague of darkness is the next to the last plague. And the death of the firstborn is the final plague. And with that, Pharaoh not only agrees that the Jews can leave, not Jews, they are not Jews yet, they are Israelites, can leave Egypt, but that they have to get out, they have to get out, and they have to get out now. So everything was a rush. Leave right now. Here's what Rabbi Sacks has to say. In September of 2020, BBC, Reuters, and other news agencies reported on a sensational scientific discovery. Researchers at the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research and the University of Colorado were able to show, through computer simulation, how the division of the Red Sea may have taken place. Using sophisticated modeling, they demonstrated how a strong east wind, blowing overnight, could have pushed water back at a bend where an ancient river is believed to have merged with a coastal lagoon. The water would have been guided into the two waterways, and a land bridge would have opened at the bend, allowing people to walk across the exposed mud flats. As soon as the wind died down, the waters would have rushed back in. As the leader of the project said when the report was published, the simulations match fairly closely with the account in Exodus. This is how the Cambridge University physicist Colin Humphreys puts it in his book, The Miracles of Exodus. He said, wind tides are well known to oceanographers. For example, a strong wind blowing along Lake Erie, one of the Great Lakes in the United States, has produced water elevation differences of as much as 16 feet between Toledo, Ohio on the west and Buffalo, New York on the east. There are reports that Napoleon was almost killed by a sudden high tide while he was crossing shallow waters near the head of the Gulf of Suez. Okay, that's Colin Humphreys in his book, The Miracles of Exodus. To me, though, the real issue is what the biblical account really is, because it is right here that we have one of the most fascinating features of the way the Torah tells its stories. Here's the key passage from the book of Exodus, this Parsha, Parsha Beishalach, chapter 14, verses 21 and 22, which reads, Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind all night, turning it into dry land and dividing the water. So the Israelites walked through the sea on dry land. To their right and left, the water was like a wall. The passage can be read two ways. The first is that what happened was a suspension of the laws of nature. It was a supernatural event. The water stood, literally, like two walls. The second is that what happened was miraculous. but not because the laws of nature were suspended. To the contrary, as the computer simulation shows, the exposure of dry land at a particular point in the Red Sea was a natural outcome of the strong east wind. What made it miraculous is that it happened just there, just then, when the Israelites seemed trapped, unable to go forward because of the sea, unable to turn back because of the Egyptian army pursuing them. There's a significant difference between these two interpretations. The first appeals to our sense of wonder. How extraordinary that the laws of nature should be suspended to allow an escaping people to go free. It is a story to appeal to the imagination of a child. But the naturalistic explanation is wondrous at another level entirely. Here, the Torah is using the device of irony. What made the Egyptians of the time of Ramses so formidable was the fact that they possessed the latest and most powerful form of military technology, the horse-drawn chariot. It made them unbeatable in battle, and it made them fearsome. What happens at the sea is poetic justice of the most exquisite kind. There is only one circumstance in which a group of people traveling by foot can escape a highly trained army of charioteers. That is, when the route passes through a muddy seabed. The people can walk across, but the chariot wheels get stuck in the mud. The Egyptian army can neither advance nor retreat. The wind drops, the water returns. The powerful are now powerless, while the powerless have made their way to freedom. The second narrative has a moral depth that the first does not, and it resonates with the message of the Book of Psalms. His pleasure is not in the strength of the horse, nor his delight in the legs of the warrior. The Lord delights in those who fear him, who put their hope in his unfailing love. In Bereshit Rabbah, it's indicated that the division of the sea was, as it were, programmed into creation from the outset. It was less a suspension of nature than an event written into nature from the beginning, to be triggered at the appropriate moment in the unfolding of history. Rabbi Jonathan said, "The Holy One, blessed be He, made a condition with the sea at the beginning of creation, that it should split asunder for the Israelites. That is the meaning of the sea went back to its full flow." From the text, the condition that God had earlier stipulated. That's Bereshit Rabbah, chapter 5, verse 5. This is Talmud. A miracle is not necessarily something that suspends natural law. It is rather an event for which there may be a natural explanation, but which, happening when, where, and how it did, evokes wonder, such that even the most hardened skeptic senses that God has intervened in history. The weak are saved, those in danger delivered. More significant still is the moral message such an event conveys, that hubris is punished by nemesis, that the proud are humbled and the humble given pride, that there is justice in history, often hidden, but sometimes gloriously revealed. The elegantly simple way in which the division of the Red Sea is described in the Torah, so that it can be read at two quite different levels, one as a supernatural miracle, the other as a moral tale about the limits of technology when it comes to the real strength of nations. That, to me, is what is most striking. It is a text, quite deliberately, written so that our understanding of it can deepen as we mature, and we are no longer so interested in the mechanics of miracles and more interested in how freedom is won or lost. To be clear, it's good to know how the division of the sea happened, but there remains a depth to the biblical story that can never be exhausted by computer simulations and other historical or scientific evidence, and depends instead on being sensitive to its deliberate and delicate ambiguity. Just as ruach, a physical wind, can part waters and expose land beneath, so too ruach, the human spirit, can expose beneath the surface of a story a deeper meaning beneath. Well, there you have Rabbi Yonatan Sacks commenting on the Parsha of the week, Parsha Beshalach, what he titles The Power of Ruach. Well, as I'm reading today, January 27, it's a day of commemoration, also a day of mourning for the Jewish people. It's a day to commemorate the Shoah, the Holocaust, the genocide of 6 million Jews during World War II. This commentary by Jonathan Tobin, who is the executive editor of the Jewish Syndicate, is what it's a newspaper and a news organization. Says that it shouldn't be a day to be remembered by everybody. There's a certain hypocrisy going on, and that's what he talks about here. He says those who support a ceasefire, talking about the conflict now in Gaza, to allow a genocidal anti-Semitic movement like Hamas to commit more slaughters of Jews should not pretend to mourn the 6 million. It's an important date on the international community's calendar. Each year, the United Nations and many other institutions and organizations hold ceremonies on January 27, commemorating the Holocaust. It's long been cleared that much of the world did so without actually thinking seriously about what allowed the Nazis' campaign of extermination of European Jewry to succeed as well as it did. Nor do most of those going through the motions of mourning the systematic murder of 6 million Jews, or making empty promises about never again, think much about how a supposedly civilized people like the Germans, with the help of various collaborators from other nations, convinced themselves that it was not only acceptable to kill that many people, but justified to do so. But this year, perhaps, they shouldn't bother to pretend to care about the subject. After the Hamas atrocities on October 7, and even more importantly, the reaction of much of the civilized world to what happened, the meaninglessness of most of what passes for the commemoration of the Shoah by the international community and the West has become painfully obvious. It goes beyond hypocrisy. To describe those who are indifferent to the mass slaughter of Jews today, but still prepared to mouth words of indignation about those killed by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s, as merely hypocritical, is insufficient. The willingness of the world, including many of the educated elites in the West, to dismiss the importance of the crimes perpetrated in southern Israel 3 months ago, to be effectively neutral about the murders, rapes, torture, and kidnapping committed by Hamas and the Palestinians, or actually to take the side of the murderers, the rapists, torturers, and kidnappers, is not just shocking. It's a seminal moment in modern history that not only illustrates the moral bankruptcy of a significant segment of contemporary opinion, but also provides an explanation for how the Holocaust happened. As hard as it may be for us to accept, this demonstrates that Holocaust commemorations, or even educational programs about the destruction of European Jewry in the mid-20th century either don't make people less likely to support more holocausts, or, even worse, all this might be counterproductive. The surge in anti-Semitism throughout the West in the aftermath of October 7, with mobs marching in the streets of major cities and on college campuses proclaiming their support for the destruction of the one Jewish state in the world, from the river to the sea, is their cry, and for terrorism against Jews in Israel and everywhere else, globalize the Intifada is another rally point. And the support such positions have received in much of the corporate media was surprising to those Jews who thought such sentiments were only held by marginal extremists. Nor can they be explained as an understandable reaction to a supposedly disproportionate Israeli response to terrorism, or as sympathy for Palestinians caught up in a war that Hamas started. What happened on October 7 in Israel should have taught the world about the intractable nature of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. The same is true for what it should have made clear about the ethos and the goals of the Hamas movement that penetrated Israel and perpetuated the unspeakable crimes committed that day, in addition to the Palestinian nationalist cause that spawned it. Yet, most of what passes for educated opinion in the West refuses to acknowledge those lessons, let alone draw conclusions from them. Anti-Semitism is not a function of ordinary unkindness, but a weapon in which the Jews are demonized to achieve a political purpose. To the contrary, the almost immediate erasure of the Israeli victims from the world's consciousness, even before the Israel Defense Forces began their campaign to try to ensure Hamas would never be able to commit such crimes again, was telling. The same is true for the widespread acceptance of the big lie that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza and the mockery of justice that has been taking place in The Hague as the UN International Court of Justice arraigned Israel on this false charge. Charge was brought by South Africa. It's not enough to note author Dara Horn's rule that people love dead Jews but don't care much for live ones, especially those fighting for their survival like the Israelis are. The willingness of so much of what passes for educated opinion to view the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians through a prism of fashionable left-wing ideology that has become the new orthodoxy in academia, as well as much of the rest of our culture, intersectionality, critical race theory, white privilege, and the woke catechism of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. This isn't merely factually incorrect and intellectually bankrupt. It demonstrates the moral sickness in contemporary society that provides a permission slip for anti-Semitism. And more importantly, it demonstrates that genuine acts of genocide are more likely to be the product of educated minds, not ignorant ones. As historian Niall Ferguson noted in a seminal essay published in the Free Press in December, the current state of American academia and Western intellectual life is not unlike what was going on in Germany prior to the Holocaust. Ferguson's theme is reflected in the title of the piece, which echoes that of French philosopher Julien Benda's classic 1927 work, The Treason of the Intellectuals, which explained how enlightened opinion in late 19th and early 20th century Europe enabled the extremism that led to the crimes of fascism and Nazism. Ferguson persuasively argues that the dehumanization of the Jews as the scapegoats for Germany's problems was something that was largely the work of intellectuals in what was then the most educated and civilized nation on earth. It was the smart people, the educated classes, not the uneducated, who enabled and ultimately set the events of the Holocaust in motion. The stance of America's great universities regarding the October 7 crimes, something about which they were largely neutral, even though they were quick to take sides during the moral panic about racism, which followed the death of George Floyd in 2020, just a few years ago, Ferguson says that was instructive. It showed just how strong the stranglehold of woke ideology had become. Critical race theory and intersectionality teach that the world is divided into two unchangeable, immutable groups locked in perpetual conflict, white oppressors and everybody else, people of color. People of color are always the victims, whites are always the oppressors. In such a moral universe, the individual actions of members of these two groups don't matter so much in determining which side is in the right. The victim class is always right, no matter how wrong their behavior or their goals. The oppressor class, white people, is always wrong, no matter how much they have been aggrieved or how justified their actions might otherwise be. Jews, special category, of course, for Jews. But Jews, and especially Israeli Jews, are not white. And the conflict with the Palestinians is not one about race. But that's how the DEI mindset categorizes Jews and Arabs. The Palestinians who committed the bestial crimes of October 7 may have been indoctrinated by radical Islam to view their Jewish victims as less than human or deserving of cruelty. Yet, the Western mobs who chant their support for such behavior or think Hamas ought not to be eradicated have a point of view that, while not necessarily steeped in ideas about Muslim supremacy in the Middle East, are still prepared to view Jews, either in Israel or encountered on the streets and campuses here in the United States, as equally undeserving of the right to exist or the right to self-defense. Woke ideas seek to permanently divide American society along racial lines. But they also dehumanize and strip those who are deemed white oppressors of equal rights. The DEI mantra is as much an inversion of the truth as the Arbeit macht frei, work will set you free, which was on the gates of Auschwitz. The diversity and inclusion it calls for actually is a mandate for the exclusion of non-approved groups, and the equity it demands is the opposite of equal opportunity, since it demands judging people by their backgrounds and their skin color, not by any individual merit. Jews, especially Israelis, are not white, and the conflict with the Palestinians is not one about race. When applied to Jews, it means that the victims of October 7 deserve no sympathy. That's why people who call themselves progressives feel justified in tearing down the posters depicting kidnapping victims, whether they are 8 months old or 85 years old. No decent person would think of tearing down a poster of a missing dog or a cat. But to those indoctrinated by diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, a kidnapped Jew is less deserving of sympathy than a lost pet. It also explains why feminists are ready to believe women who are victims of sexual crimes and yet so readily dismiss those committed against Jewish women, even when Palestinians use rape as a weapon of war. By the same token, Israeli actions may be demonized and delegitimized as genocide, even though they are nothing of the kind, because, as white oppressors, they are always immoral. Everything they do is immoral. A process of dehumanization of Jews led an educated nation to become Hitler's willing executioners and active participants in the murder of 6 million Jews. The same treason of the intellectuals now does the same thing to Jews of Israel and Jews elsewhere who stand with them. The sort of Holocaust education and commemoration that has become commonplace in the United States in the last generation, in which anti-Semitism is considered to be just another form of intolerance, does little to combat woke indifference to assaults on its designated white evildoers. Anti-Semitism is not a function of ordinary unkindness, but a weapon in which the Jews are demonized to achieve a political purpose. That is how Jewish victims of terrorism can be erased and their plight put down as what happens to oppressors who run afoul of an act of justified resistance. Hamas, which is a movement that has the support of most Palestinians and now the sympathy of many Western intellectuals, explicitly seeks the elimination of the one Jewish state on the planet and the genocide of its 7 million Jews. What happened on October 7 was merely the trailer for what it intends to do in the near future. There is no middle ground on this subject. Anyone who is indifferent about what happened on October 7, or who claims that all of the peoples in the world, the Jews alone, are undeserving of a state or the right to self-defense, that's called anti-Zionism, or who argues that Hamas must be allowed, via a ceasefire, to survive the current war and be left in charge of any part of Gaza or anywhere else where it will rearm and prepare itself, as it pledges to do, and commit many more such atrocities, and they cannot be allowed to call themselves progressives or opposed to genocide. Because what they are doing by taking such a stand is essentially putting themselves on the side of those who wish for a second Holocaust in Israel. That's why I don't want to hear a single word of Holocaust commemoration from anyone this year who isn't prepared to unreservedly support Israel's justified war to eliminate Hamas in the same manner that the Allies belatedly destroyed Adolf Hitler's Third Reich. In the months since October 7, we have seen what this generation's treason of the intellectuals has wrought as anti-Semitic ideas, conduct, and speech have once again become commonplace. If you are not willing to stand with the Jewish state against Islamist murderers and their woke fellow travelers and useful idiots, then at least have the decency not to bother us with your insincere grief about the Holocaust. Well, I have to say, hypocrisy has never slowed down anyone on the left, never really given them cause for thought. If they did have cause for thought or cause to pause to think, they might come to some very different conclusions than what they in fact come to. Well, that was Jonathan Tobin, and this article was written for the Jewish News Syndicate, titled "A Holocaust, a Hollow Holocaust Remembrance Day." Well, don't think that these ideas are only in the United States or only in Europe or only any place. They seem to have legs and they're going all kinds of places. including in the United States Congress. Now here's a headline. The Senate and the House Democrats push Palestinian statehood. 48 of 100 lawmakers in the Senate, the United States Senate, the upper chamber, joined the call. Democrats in both chambers of the U.S. Congress have expressed support for a Palestinian state in recent days, despite Israeli opposition to the move as a threat to its security. Senator Brian Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, led 48 Democrat senators and Senator Bernie Sanders, who calls himself, what does he call himself? Well, he calls himself a progressive. But anyway, not officially a Democrat, although he caucuses with Democrats. Well, anyway, Senator Schatz and Senator Bernie Sanders Wednesday of this week announced plans to introduce a two-page amendment to the National Security Supplemental Package, affirming that U.S. policy is to support a two-state solution. Two Democrats in the 100-member chamber did not sign on to the measure. Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat from West Virginia, and Senator John Fetterman, Democrat from Pennsylvania. A spokesperson for Fetterman told Axios that while the former progressive and current pro-Israel moderate supports a two-state solution, he also strongly believes that this resolution should include language stipulating the destruction of Hamas as a precondition to peace. On the other side of the Capitol, 44 House Democrats signed a letter sent to President Joe Biden on Tuesday, calling for a two-state solution as the only viable path for a sustainable peace between the Israeli and the Palestinian people. This letter, led by Representatives Raja Krishnamurthy, Democrat from Illinois, and Jim Hines, Democrat from Connecticut, also criticizes Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent remarks rejecting Palestinian statehood. Netanyahu said in a TV address on January 18 that, quote, Gaza must be demilitarized under Israel's full security control, and added, I will not compromise on full Israeli security control of all territory west of the Jordan River. Well, predictably, his comments drew a backlash from the Biden administration, Democrat members of Congress, the European Union, and, ready, the United Nations. Earlier this week, the Republican Jewish Coalition slammed the Biden administration for its growing pressure on Israel to support the creation of a Jewish state. He said, today Israel is at war against the monstrous terrorists who perpetrated the October 7 atrocities. Dozens of Israelis remain captives of Hamas, and no Palestinian faction has condemned the horror that led to the current crisis, stated Norm Coleman and Matt Brooks, national chairman and CEO, respectively, of the RJC, Republican Jewish Committee. Until those objectives are accomplished, pressuring the Jewish state to make irreversible and potentially perilous long-term diplomatic commitments is a grave failure to live up to America's proud history of standing with Israel against its deadly enemies. Let's be clear. As long as the Palestinian Authority is still rewarding terrorist murderers through its massive pay-for-slay subsidies and refusing to condemn the October 7 atrocities, it remains unfit to administer a Palestinian state either. Well, it seems to be some agreement on that in Israel, but long ways from being really unique. Well, anyway, there you have it. The Senate and the House Democrats pushing for Palestinian statehood. And what that would accomplish, if it were to happen, is a Palestinian state with all the advantages of any other state, meaning they could order weapons from international markets with impunity. They could order poisons. They could order all kinds of armaments. They could build a navy and an army and an air force, and they're sworn to do that, so that Israel can be confronted, as they like to put it. But what it really means is them lying like rats and poisoning everything they come in touch with. Well, right here in River City, in the Congress. Okay, that was the Senate and House Democrats pushing Palestinian statehood. See what happens with that. Let's move on to the next one. You've heard of UNRWA, the United Nations, you know, the pious, standing for the Palestinians and observing solemn ceremonies for Holocaust Memorial Day. Well, they've been uncovered a little bit here, and they say that it's extremely troubled by allegations that 12, at least, UNRWA staff took part in the October 7 attack. The United States has suspended funding, and I have heard that so has England and France, Great Britain and Australia. That is, not of the UN, but of UNRWA, which is a UN organization. Quote here, I have taken the decision to immediately terminate the contracts of these staff members and launch an investigation, said Philippe Lazzarini, UNRWA Commissioner General. Okay, the United States is suspending additional funding to UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East. That's what UNRWA is. And they're doing that temporarily as it reviews charges that 12, at least, UNRWA employees took part in Hamas' October 7 terror attack on Israel. The United States is extremely troubled by these allegations, stated Matthew Miller, the U.S. State Department spokesman. Miller added that the United States is reviewing the steps that the United Nations is taking to address these issues. United States Secretary of State Anthony Blinken spoke with Antonio Guterres, UN Secretary General, on January 25th to, quote, emphasize the necessity of a thorough and swift investigation of this matter. We welcome the decision to conduct such an investigation and Secretary General Guterres's pledge to take decisive action to respond should the allegations prove accurate, Miller said. We also welcome the UN's announcement of a comprehensive and independent review of UNRWA. There must be a complete accountability for anyone who participated in the heinous attacks of October 7, he added. Washington has also contacted the Israeli government to seek more information about these allegations and has briefed members of Congress. We will remain in close contact with the UN and government of Israel regarding this matter, Miller said. He added that UNRWA plays a critical role in providing life-saving assistance to Palestinians, including essential food, medicine, shelter, and other vital humanitarian support. What they don't say, in terms of aid given the Palestinians, is that they also turn a blind eye. UNRWA has long been accused of anti-Semitism, including that its teachers glorify the October 7 attack in Israel, that aid is passing through its hands to Hamas, and that Hamas terrorists hide in its schools. The Israeli authorities have provided UNRWA with information about the alleged involvement of several UNRWA employees in the horrific attacks on Israel on October 7, said Philippe Lanzarini, UNRWA Special Commissioner General. To protect the agency's ability to deliver humanitarian assistance, I have taken the decision to immediately terminate the contracts of these staff members and launch an investigation in order to establish the truth without delay, says Lazzarini. Any UNRWA employee who is involved in acts of terror will be held accountable, including through criminal prosecution. UNRWA reiterates its condemnation in the strongest possible terms of the abhorrent attacks October 7 and calls for the immediate and unconditional release of all Israeli hostages and their safe return to their families. These shocking allegations come as more than 2 million people in Gaza depend on life-saving assistance that the agency has been providing since the war began. Anyone who betrays the fundamental values of the UN, United Nations, also betrays those values whom we serve in Gaza, across the region, and elsewhere in the world. Well, nice talk. Representative Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey, chair of the House Global Human Rights and International Organizations Subcommittee, referred to the Biden administration's decision to suspend funding for UNRWA temporarily as long overdue and still a feeble response to the massive and irrefutable evidence of UNRWA's extensive and long-term connivance, complicity, and even cooperation in the Hamas terror organization. When faced with a mountain of information, President Trump suspended all U.S. funding to UNRWA, but tragically, the Biden administration resumed support for UNRWA. Now, in view of public pressure motivated by explosive new evidence of UNRWA's involvement in the October 7 terror attack, the Biden administration has announced a review of the limited allegations relating to October 7. That's totally insufficient, he added. What we need is a comprehensive, fact-based approach to UNRWA that stops all funding and conditions, future funding, to a complete head-to-toe reform and restructuring of UNRWA. Pastor John Hagee, founder and chairman of Christians United for Israel, stated that he is appalled, but he said, I am not surprised. The UN is a cesspool of anti-Israel hatred, and UNRWA is one of the primary organs associated with normalizing and institutionalizing international anti-Semitism. Reinstating funding for UNRWA was a mistake. We knew UNRWA was complicit in Hamas' anti-Semitic indoctrination of generations of Gazans. But it's clear also they've taken the next logical step, joining Hamas in a terror attack. While we welcome the decision to stop funding UNRWA, the Biden administration should make this temporary pause permanent, according to Sandra Parker, chair of the Citizens United for Israel Action Fund on campus. Unfortunately, the State Department's actions in this context is typical of their too little, too late approach to the Middle East. No U.S. taxpayer dollars should have been flowing to UNRWA, just as no sanctions relief should have been provided to Iran. Parker added, I'd love to believe the Biden administration has learned its lesson, but how much time do we really believe will pass before the White House turns the spigot back on? And by the spigot, they mean for not just policy papers, but homegrown letters. pleas often for taxpayer and human support. Mark Melman, president and CEO of the Democrat Majority for Israel, welcomed the State Department's announcement. He said UN employees are required to be neutral in politics and to avoid criminal activity. UNRWA and its employees have long violated those principles. That UNRWA employees actively participated in savage terrorism is a deplorable and permanent stain on the UN and on UNRWA. Providing humanitarian aid to Palestinians is a vital objective, but it must be done in a way that does not support terrorism. Democrat Majority for Israel has called regularly for UNRWA, which has long incited hatred and violence, to be reformed. The Democrat Majority for Israel organization has called regularly for UNRWA, which has long incited hatred and violence, to be reformed. Through its statements and actions, UNRWA has become a serious obstacle to peace. We now find that its employees also participate in mass murder, torture, rape, and kidnapping. Donors must insist on a complete overhaul and reform of UNRWA, according to Melman. We urge the administration to make the current pause the beginning of that root and branch remaking of this agency, which is so badly off track. I'll just have to say here as an aside that accusations of complicit behavior with Palestinian terrorists has been a complaint about UNRWA for many years, as has anti-Israel incitement in the schools been a complaint of UNRWA. UNRWA funds and supports and runs most of the schools in the Palestinian Authority and Gaza areas as well. So it's nothing new. It's just now these people have had direct involvement. 12 of them have had direct involvement in the attacks of October 7. Former President Donald Trump, by the way, cut off all funding to the Palestinian Authority as long as they had their pay for slay program, where they gave money to anyone that was arrested by Israel for terrorism or killed in the line of committing acts of terror, or just committed terrorist attacks and got away with it. They supported them. They gave them money. Trump ended all that. The Biden administration has turned it back on. That was one of the first things they did when they took office. So you want more terrorism? The best way to get it is to fund it. Well, here's one more. The Jewish N-word and why we should guard it. Interesting essay. This is written for Tablet Magazine by Shalom Auslander. Here's what he says. God, under pressure from his investors, was finalizing his sketches for mankind when he realized he had a problem. He wanted man to praise him, to thank him, to glorify his name. He hadn't yet created self-esteem. But in order for man to glorify his name, man would have to say his name. God was no idiot. God knew that if man ran around saying his name often enough, eventually his name would become powerless and insignificant. Soon enough, man would be calling it out while tugging his wife's hair and hoping the kids didn't walk in. So step one, God created another word, forbidden. Then the commandment, don't say that word or else. Some years later, Lenny Bruce would make the same observation as God. Personally, I think God got the idea from Lenny. This time regarding the N-word used to denigrate African Americans. Endless repetition, said Lenny, repeating the word endlessly, would eventually cause the word to lose its power. So, my fellow Jews, let's talk Nazis. Recently, the digital platform Substack came under fire for what a journalist from The Atlantic deemed its Nazi problem. There were Nazis on Substack, the journalist journaled, and Nazis were bad, and Substack was bad for allowing Nazis. And not only were the Nazis profiting, but Substack was profiting from the Nazis too, and the Nazis were only going to get worse, which is what Nazis do, the lousy Nazis. The national news media picked up the story. The outrage machine kicked into high gear, and earlier this week, Substack took the Nazi Substacks down. God has rather draconian opinions on free speech, but some of us mortals have tried to do our best to protect it, minorities in particular, knowing that the sword of censorship maims none so mortally as the powerless. Most often, we talk about protecting its free use. But I'd like to speak here a little bit, just Jew to Jew, about another form of protecting speech, and that is protecting words from overuse, because words matter. "I am all these words," wrote Samuel Beckett, who worked for the French resistance against the Nazis, "this dust of words. We should protect these words. These are our words." And words die. They expire from overuse. They wither by want, and the word Nazi is on life support. When I was a child, the word Nazi was rarely used, if ever. Someone might have been a bigot, or a Jew hater, or, when it was really serious, an anti-Semite. But only a Nazi was a Nazi. Nazis were the demonic soldiers in the newsreels we were shown on Holocaust Memorial Day, from the very first grade in yeshiva, laughing as they bulldozed corpses of Jews into hideous gray heaps and then set them on fire. Nazis were the ghouls shooting naked children in the back and smiling as their once warm, once cuddled, nevermore bodies tumbled lifeless into the mass grave below. The word had power. The word could shake the earth. The word was sacred. And then something changed. Suddenly it seemed everyone was a Nazi. Jesse Jackson was a Nazi. David Bowie was a Nazi. The President of the United States, whoever he was a Nazi. A Nazi whose Nazism was defended by what people in my community often referred to as the New York Nazi Times. Our Catholic neighbor was a Nazi just for driving past our house on Friday night. I gasped when I first heard it used so cavalierly. Something holy had been profaned. And slowly, the word as God knew it would begin to lose its power. Today, like other degraded words, words that once had crucial pivotal power but are now exhausted, words that society desperately needs like racist and sexist and homophobe, the word Nazi has been made impotent and toothless. If I was a theorist of a more conspiratorial bent, I would suspect a secret plot to destroy the word, to reduce it to nothing, a linguistic form of Holocaust denial. What can't be denied can at least be minimized. Some months ago, the Anti-Defamation League announced that acts of, quote, anti-Semitism have increased by a significant degree. What they didn't announce was that they had changed their definition of the word anti-Semitism to include any and all criticism or protest of Israel. So, of course, anti-Semitism increased. If they'd included choosing the croissant over the bagel, we'd have a full-blown genocide on our hands. By the ADL's current definition, I am an anti-Semite. And Edgar Carrot, a longtime critic of Netanyahu, is an anti-Semite. The 70,000 Israelis I marched with last summer in Tel Aviv against Netanyahu are anti-Semites. And the hundreds of thousands of Israelis that protested Netanyahu over the last year, some 60% of the nation's entire population, well, they're anti-Semites too. And so soon the word anti-Semite will be dead as well. A sixth grader scrawling a swastika on the wall of his school bathroom is not an anti-Semite. According to the ADL, he is, and they count him in their numbers. He's an asshole. He also scrawled, I'll just say that what he scrawled is profane and won't repeat it. Well, this guy may even be a colossal asshole, but an anti-Semite, is the word really that cheap? A few months ago, a friend of mine's sister was out for a pleasant walk with her husband, taking in the beauty of nature and breathing deep of the cool morning air, when a man drove by and shot her husband in the chest. Then he shot her in the face. Her husband likely died immediately, and she was confirmed dead last week. Judith Weinstein Haggai, her phone still pinging in a tunnel somewhere under Gaza. That's an anti-Semite. Words die. We should protect them. These are our words. Why do we allow them to become so degraded? Why do we degrade them ourselves? Would anyone be so sanguine if I were to push my chair from the lunch table, pat my stomach, and say, "Boy, I really raped that burger"? Of course not. The word is important. So why are our words any less so? Why are they so cheap? If Kanye West is a Nazi, how bad could a Nazi be? Is he even worth spending the word anti-Semite on? Or is he just a mental patient off his maximum strength meds? Danger, keep away from children meds. He's as much a Nazi as the lunatic on the street corner who called me a fag this morning. Is a homophobe. Are ill-informed college students anti-Semites when they shout slogans they just heard but don't understand? Or are they just typical self-righteous, know-it-all, while-knowing-nothing college assholes? Lenny himself mocked them way back in the 60s when he joked about one who, while protesting police brutality, berates a man in uniform he thinks is a cop. "Gestapo," the uniformed man replies. "You asshole, I'm a mailman." Well, if asshole's good enough for Lenny, it's good enough for me. We have enemies, it's true. As Delmore Schwartz wrote, even paranoids have real enemies. But Delmore suffered from severe mental illness, and he drank himself to death in such terrible isolation, it was days before anyone even knew he was dead. Is Nazi, too, already dead? Is anti-Semite? Who is to blame? It will have to be us. The word Nazi deserves protection. We are the people of the book, after all. Words are our wheelhouse. And the God of that book knew well that a word abused becomes a word without power. As it turns out, regarding the Nazis on Substack, reported breathlessly around the world, there were in total 6 of them. The original article, written by a Jew, failed to mention that. To put that in context, my 2 ultra-Orthodox brothers-in-law have between them 3 times as many children as Substack has Nazis. It's not even a minion. Are the Substack Nazis real Nazis? I don't know. If they are, my Israeli nephews alone could screw them up. What I do know is that words die from overuse, and once they die, God help us, they don't return. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that does it for this edition of Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community. I want to thank you for joining me today for these Readings of Interest to the Jewish Community and remind you, my name is Michael Wolin. And in parting, I'd like to wish you all a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, and Shavua Tov. Have a good week.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.